my why, like my reason for being here is to improve human performance so that people can do what they love always. That is what I, what gets me up every day, is that idea that I want you to be able to do what you love forever, as long as you're on this earth, because I've had the experience of having to face, like, I'm not gonna be able to do this anymore.
Hi, and welcome to the Innovative Mindset Podcast. I'm your host, Isolde Trachtenberg. On the show, you get my conversations with peak performing thought leaders, entrepreneurs, and creatives. Every week, you can get their secrets so you can raise your game too. Today's episode is going to knock your socks off. You're going to learn how your brain and body work together to either get in your way or help you succeed. DM me at IsoldeT on Instagram with your biggest takeaway. I'd love to hear what you're thinking. And now, let's get on with the show. Hello, and welcome to the Innovative Mindset Podcast. My name is Isolde Trachtenberg, and I am super thrilled you're here. And I am incredibly honored and thrilled to have this week's guest and to introduce you to him. I'm so excited. My mouth isn't working. It happens sometimes. Andrew Byrne is the founder of The Singing Athlete, and I cannot wait to talk about what that is. A training program that brings sports performance and neuroscience into the voice studio. How amazing is that? He is based in New York City, and his students have appeared in leading roles in over 75 Broadway shows. In 2016, Andrew was the first arts envoy appointed by the U.S. State Department to the nation of Belarus. It's another kind of thing we share, since I was born in Moldova, which is just a couple
of... Oh my God, really?
Over. Yeah. Cool. Yeah. I'm an immigrant. I was born in the former Soviet Union. So let me finish talking about you, Andrew, because there's so much more to say.
I got excited. Sorry.
No worries at all. I love it. So twice named New York City's favorite vocal coach in Backstage's Reader Choice Award. Now that's a big deal, because Backstage is the performer's sort of format. So he's the performer's favorite vocal coach. You got to remember that. Andrew travels the world to bring his brand of brain-focused training to singers across the globe. In 2016, he was appointed by the U.S. State Department, as I said, as the first envoy to the nation of Belarus, and he led the inaugural Russian language production of Next to Normal. Now, what's really interesting, Andrew, do you speak Russian?
You know, I don't. I got the job sort of at the last minute, and so I had time to just take a few Russian lessons, and I learned how to say the basics and how to say diaphragm and tongue and things I needed to talk about from a singing perspective.
I loved the
little Russian that I got to do. I found it to be such an amazing language to work with. I honestly just loved the feeling of speaking it too. I really enjoyed it. So it was a brief study of it, but I hope to do more.
Oh, that's so fabulous. Well, we'll have to do that. I'll help you practice your Russian, since Russian is my first language. Anyway.
I can do some Russian.
Да, конечно, мы будем. So let me finish your introduction, because obviously this is already gone off the rails. So Andrew's other international teaching assignments have taken him to Singapore, Switzerland, Denmark, France, China, and many times to Australia. And this is something really cool that Andrew and I share, aside from both of us having grown up in Michigan, because Andrew's enjoyed 4 teaching residencies in Canada, close to Michigan, and then served as guest faculty at the University of Michigan Musical Theater Department, where I graduated from. Not the musical theater department, I was English drama, not musical theater, but it's so cool and wonderful that we share that. So officially now, Andrew, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Isolde. I'm so happy to be with you today.
I'm so excited to have you here, because you are a true educator. You help people achieve their dreams, and I think that's what an educator's role is. But before we go into what you do, I'd love to talk to you a little bit about your arts education. What got you started in singing and eventually combining athletics and singing? But can you talk a little bit about your early arts education and exposure to theater, singing, musical theater, art in general?
Absolutely. So I come from a music family, especially on my mother's side. So 2 of her sisters when I was growing up were professional musicians. So one was pursuing opera in New York City. The other was a pianist, piano teacher out in the Bay Area. And so I grew up being surrounded by classical music. That was just part of my life. My mom's father was a very active amateur musician and played a lot of instruments. And so my brother's also in music. We had a ton of exposure to that when we were young. And I think that really led both of us down the path of pursuing it as a lifelong study. And yeah, I did, you know, shows when I was young. I did choir, band, basically anything I could get my hands on that involved music. And along the way, I fell in love with playing for singers. So starting in high school, I earned money by accompanying singers on the piano. And throughout college and grad school, that's how I supported myself. So I did what I consider to be an old school apprenticeship. So I would come early to the voice lessons. I would take notes on what the teacher was saying and what exercises they were giving the student. As a male voice, that's how I learned to work with females, to hear smart teachers talk about it. And so I did that for many years of my life. And that's really how I came to do what I do, to have the exposure to so many different perspectives on a way that something can be said to a singer. And I feel that if there is a way it can be said, I've probably heard it just from being exposed to so many teachers and so many different methodologies. That's kind of allowed me to synthesize something for myself.
So it sounds to me like you've taken the best and the most effective of the advice that you heard given and transformed it and molded it into what you now teach. Is that an accurate assessment?
Yeah, I think so. So, you know, I've always been fascinated by art and by science. And so if we think sort of scientific method of like taking what I heard and trying it with my sample of people and seeing what I felt were the most effective things across the broadest spectrum. I think the thing that I love most about working with singers is that everyone has their own voice and there is no magic thing that everybody needs to be told or to do to be a better singer. And that's what has always made it for me so fascinating. I have yet to wake up any day and not want to do it since I was 18. And so it's, I think, because I'm so interested in people and how they process and how they learn. And so that's really kept me interested. And I'm constantly thinking about how I can be more effective as a teacher. What are things that I can do that will get results with the broadest spectrum of folks?
I love the fact that you state plainly that every singer is an individual and every singer is going to need something different to help them bring out their best voice. And yet, this idea of the scientific, I love that you use the scientific method too. I was a NASA trainer for many years and worked at one of the big science agencies.
Awesome.
So I love the idea of the juxtaposition of art and science. How do you bring science to that individual lesson, to that individual singer? What do you do to assess them scientifically and then to help them both artistically and scientifically?
Yeah, so that kind of gets into what I do now, which is to really try to blend neuroscience and performance. And so the idea would be the assessment phase for a singer is to sing something. So if someone working with someone in a show, they say to me, I'm having trouble with this one phrase, doesn't feel quite right. So they'll sing it for me and I will use all of my senses, visual, auditory, kinesthetic, sort of spiritual, and trying to just figure out what's going on with that. And then I'm going to go through, based on my observation, some tests to go, well, okay, so it looks like, let's say the left side of your face is drooping down a little bit when you're singing that phrase. Let's see if you're feeling that side of your face correctly. We can do some nerve testing over there and see how that's going. Oh, interesting. You don't feel that middle branch of your face on that side. Let's provide some stimulus to that branch of your face. Let's try it again and see what happened. And then that's the reassessment to go, did your nervous system, did your brain appreciate that stimulus or not? Is that the direction that we need to go to get this to happen? So I can hopefully give you something to do before you walk on for that song or that scene that's gonna get your brain feeling safe enough to let out whatever needs to happen. And in the neuroscience world, there's so much interest around singing specifically because it is this reflexive action. The vocal cords are moving extremely fast. A high C that an opera soprano sings is about 1,000 times per second that the vocal cords are opening and closing, which is obviously a pretty fast tempo to control consciously. So it's this really reflexive part of the brain that makes it a very fascinating area for study, I think.
So much of what you just said is incredibly fascinating to me. And I'm going to try and remember everything that you said so that I can actually ask the questions. So when you test someone's face or something like that, when you're testing for a neural response, how do you do that? What are you doing to test it?
Yeah. So my training has been through a company called ZHealth, which is a company based in Las Vegas now. They were in Phoenix till recently. And so it's a company that teaches what's called functional applied neuroscience. So that is, it's a company that focuses on working with athletic trainers. So working with Olympic athletes and trying to get them to have the best experience they can in their athletic endeavors. And so I have studied with them for many years. I'm a master practitioner with that methodology. And so I essentially apply that information for singers. So we use testing that you would do in like a neuroscience clinic, but we use it for different reasons. So someone might be, you know, having a serious enough issue to go see a neurologist. We're using it for less severe situations, but knowing that big things come from small things, meaning that if you have a little deficit, say in your trigeminal nerve in your face, which is what that example I gave is, you want to know that. You want to know that, oh, I don't feel that very well over there. And knowing that that stuff is changeable because the brain is constantly changing and learning, and you can affect change in almost any system, but first you have to know that it's happening. And so that's where I come in as your coach to go, interesting, this is a deficit that you have. Let's work with it and see if that's unlocking anything for you. And if it is, great, I'm gonna give you homework around that. And over time, look to see that function improve in whatever we have discovered together.
Okay, so you give exercises, things like that for but if you're in a situation where the person's about to go on stage in a little while and they're having trouble, what would you do immediately to stimulate? How would you stimulate that nerve or that part of the face or whatever the issue is? We can keep going with that example. That works.
Sure, really. Sure. So let's just say that's what's happening. Let's say someone has something down on a side of their face and that's affecting their voice. So before they walk on, I would probably use some kind of sensory work for them because the brain is a sensory experience. It is sensory before motor in terms of how food gets into the brain. So air, oxygen, carbon dioxide balance, and glucose that is extracted from food, the way that enters the brain is first through what's called the somatosensory cortex and then into the motor cortex. So we can surmise that in many cases, sensory stuff is as important, if not more, than motor, than movement. So I would be testing different sensations on that person's face. There are things like light touch or vibration or hot or cold. You can do what's called sharp and dull, which is taking something like a retracted mechanical pencil and you can tap the sharp end and the dull eraser end onto your face. So let's just say it was light touch was helpful for that person. When they did that, they improved. I would have them backstage doing a little bit of light touch, a little bit of just light scratching on whatever part of their face wasn't likely to stay awake. And then I would have them go on in the show and they tell me their next lesson. Yeah, that worked. That helped. I felt more able to get through whatever, or that didn't work. That wasn't what I needed. And then we're going to try something else. We're going to keep experimenting until we find something that for that individual nervous system seems to get them to feel safe enough to let their voice open up and to let what needs to happen, happen.
There's so much. Okay. So yeah, because this is, I teach voice as well on a much smaller scale than you do. And it's interesting because when I do it, it's a much more, like what you said was you almost use a spiritual sense to see what's going on with the singer. And it's almost like a perception activity when I'm watching a singer. Right now I'm teaching singing classes online and I'm watching singers sing and I'm seeing, you know, they're not right there. So there's a one layer of sort of beyond what you can actually do with not being there. The tactile sense is not actually present.
Right.
But that perception, that perceptive sense, that kinesthetic sense, that it has to be really wide awake. And so I would love to ask you, when you are sensing that sort of spiritual aspect of what they're doing, how do you translate that into the science of how you're going to help them?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I have always been sort of a natural with that, where even from my beginning of my teaching career, which I started teaching voice in 1993, I've always just been kind of good at sensing that stuff. And that I would say is just one of my gifts as a teacher. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the process since then for me, pardon me, a lot of the process since then for me has been really trying to figure out a little more of a system to help others understand what I do, because mm-hmm. it is, as you know, some people just kind of have that, and yet there needs to be some kind of method put forth. So mm-hmm. I just published a book, which is my attempt to put that into a more structured form for people to start to process. Mm-hmm. And so the book is called The Singing Athlete: Brain-Based Training for Your Voice. And so it's something that is a really essentially a training system. So I created an entire online portal that comes with the book that you get for free when you buy the book. And it is about 150 video exercises. And so that's an attempt to put it into some kind of framework that mm-hmm. People can understand. And it's just, look, I decided to frame the book around different areas and structures of the body. So I start with breathing, and then I kind of go from there through structures of singing that are traditionally talked about, and then other things that aren't traditionally talked about, including a huge chapter on hearing and balance, and then also a very large chapter on vision. So those are things that I find to be not talked about in many vocal pedagogies, or really any that I've come across. And I've found them to be very, very helpful for performers. So that's sort of my attempt to put it into a frame that people can get.
I love the idea that you have this system that is all inclusive, that a singer or you know what, you don't even have to be a singer. I think that fair, what yeah. you're talking about, anybody who does any kind of presenting or speaking or performing right. could probably get a lot out of this. And what I'm curious about is how different have you found it to be teaching individually, personally, from the people who get the book and do the system? What is the difference between the two for you? And what do you think the difference is between the two for the people who buy the book versus people who are your students in New York City or wherever you're teaching?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I travel the world teaching a course called The Singing Athlete. And the way that course is structured is that if it's like a day course, it's divided in half. So the morning is done as not really lecture, but it's done as sort of an experiential thing for the group where mm-hmm. we're going through exercises, we're learning the basic framework of what I'm going to be talking about, and then experiencing that with partners or with ourselves or with a group. And then after the break, it's a masterclass. So that mm-hmm. means that you're going to see me work with singers individually and apply what I spoke about. Mm-hmm. So the feedback that I normally get is the morning was really cool. It was great to learn that. But once I saw you do it with the singer, like I saw you go, oh, they can't hit that high note. Oh, weird. You looked over here and then you could hit the high note. Then that starts to really get people to buy in to the idea of this. As you said, a more inclusive look at voice training, mm-hmm. realizing that really any body system could be having an effect because these nerves are more jumbled together in our brain than we might think. And we tend to look biomechanically at the body to go, oh, your larynx is doing this, which is not an invaluable perspective. But if that doesn't fix it, then you have to go, well, there's something else going on. And there might be a higher order system that is not allowing you to do whatever you're supposed to be doing with your larynx. And so that is, I find when people can see me put it on a body, they understand. So yeah, it's been honestly very vulnerable to put it out there without that element, because I have found that to be one of the most easy ways for people to really get it. And so I've been heartened, honestly, by the response I've gotten so far, because people have been telling me that they're still getting a lot out of it. People who I don't know who are saying, you know, I'm incorporating these exercises into my practice. I'm hearing from a lot of people who teach yoga, teach gyrotonic, Pilates, who are studying the book and are going, yeah, I'm incorporating these into my lessons with my clients, and I'm really enjoying that. So those are my people who can think creatively and go, there's something here, let me start to experiment with my population and see what happens. And so eventually I hope to, you know, get back to traveling the world again. And with this book now, having people something to continue study after I leave them. But yeah, it's certainly a big challenge. And the reason I did all this video was to try to give people some kind of experience of this is how this works. And I use myself in the videos as an example. So I use my own function or dysfunction to go, as when I was shooting them, I would, you know, go, oh, today I'm not doing very well over here. So I would sing something and then I would go, all right, I'm going to do the exercise on myself. Now I'm going to sing again. Sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't. And I just left that on the videos to go, yeah, you know, that's what happened when I did it. And that was the best way I could think to kind of demonstrate it.
And I think that's so great that there it is. And I appreciate you saying that it's vulnerable to all of a sudden put your baby out there and go, yeah, hopefully it will fly without me being right there right in person.
Yeah.
And I completely understand that. And yet it's a way to allow people to expand and extrapolate what you've given them to their own, as you said, to their own populations. And I would love to find out, you decided that the singing athlete, as I said, there's so much to talk about. So you decided singing athlete. Yeah. What part does athletics play? How did you marry the two, but how did you get from athlete to singer? And I'll say it this way, because I tell every singing class I ever teach, I believe singing should be an Olympic sport. That is the first sentence I say every time I talk to anybody about singing.
Amen. And
so I know I am your people. I need
you are my people. You are.
So let's ask that question. How did that marriage come about? The athletics and the singing. How did it come about for you?
That's a great question. So it started for me over 20 years ago. So I was having, when I was in college, having terrible performance anxiety. And I was working with a great teacher who didn't know much about the body, but had some really good instincts. And they had just installed a Pilates reformer studio in my school. And she said, I think you should go do this. And I did, and I stopped having performance anxiety, which I did not understand at the time, but just knew that it had fixed something and never had it come back. And am now able to perform piano, voice, anything with no visible symptoms like that. And what the teacher had never asked me about was that I had an inguinal hernia when I was 4. And so I had it repaired, obviously, but I was 4 and I looked like I moved fine. So no one ever did any rehab for me on it. They were like, you're good, you're all set. And I was not fine in that area. I had a lot of reduced sensation in my left abdominals, a lot of reduced strength in my left abdominals. And now having studied brain and the vagus nerve specifically a lot, I understand why I was having terrible anxiety when I performed and why just doing simple exercises on the reformer all of a sudden made me not feel nervous anymore. And so that is really where the idea started to crystallize for me, was there's something to this physical stuff. And then along the way, I became a successful pianist in New York. I played in Broadway pit orchestras, and I was also running a music directing career where I often conducted from the piano, which is sort of a very interesting physical thing to be doing. You're using your head a lot to try to cue people while you're playing with two hands. So it's an interesting sort of physical challenge. And although my anxiety had gone down, I still hadn't really dealt with some issues in terms of how I was moving. And I started to get terrible pain in my elbow that eventually moved into my shoulder. And I was doing Ragtime, which is my personal favorite show. It was a dream contract for me to do. And I would start the first notes, which are ba-na-ba-ba-na-na. I would start that first thing and my left elbow would throb at the beginning of a 3-hour show. And
wow,
by the end, my left hand would be bright red. I started having nerve symptoms, tingling, heat, all that stuff in my left arm. So I thought I was going to have to quit. And that was really sad for me, because to this day, this is the only thing I've ever wanted to do with my life. And I had to really go to the place of, is there something else that I want to do? And the answer was no. I really feel like I'm here to do this. So I had to fix myself. So I did that through a lot of things, starting with Alexander Technique, which I had had some experience with earlier in my career, but really got serious about, and that helped a great deal. And I went back to Pilates and to what's called gyrotonic, which The combination therein somehow did the trick. And I'm now 18 years after that, I've had zero reoccurrence of that problem. And so I credit that with getting back in touch with my body and having better, clearer coaching on that with getting me out of pain. And so that was, became my life's mission. So what I say to people is that my why, like my reason for being here, is to improve human performance so that people can do what they love always. That is what I, what gets me up every day, is that idea that I want you to be able to do what you love forever, as long as you're on this earth, because I've had the experience of having to face, like, I'm not gonna be able to do this anymore. And it's feeling very emotional to talk about that today, honestly, because so many people that are in my life can't do what they love right now. And so it is now my mission, like this year, is to try to figure out how to sustain artists through a time where we're not able to do what we love, at least not in the way that we love to do it. And so that's kind of what led me through the path of athletics, eventually to the brain. And the combination therein has just been very life-changing for my own body and my own self. So I try to share that with anyone who's curious about it.
I feel like applauding you right now. I feel like that's something that I should stand up and cheer. Because I mean, what a wonderful mission. And Ragtime is one of my favorite shows. Also amazing. Do.
I know. Right.
And immediately I start weeping.
Chills as soon as I hear that theme.
I know. And it's so funny. It's a trigger for me now. From the beginning to when mother says, please take Miss Sarah inside.
Boom. Oh God.
Just weeping.
I could cry right now just hearing that. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I love what you said about the mission, about figuring out a way to sustain artists right now, especially we're in a situation where it's Broadway, for example, is dark through the autumn and correct, into the winter. And I would love, sometime I'd love to have you back to talk about this idea of sustaining artists.
Yeah.
What are your, real quickly, because I know we have so many other things to talk about. What are your ideas about that? Do you have any right now that you're pursuing?
Yeah, I do. So, I mean, for years I've been developing online resources for singers for the simple reason that, as you said at the beginning, I grew up in suburban Michigan. I had good voice and piano teachers. They were great, but you know, when I went further and worked with others, I was like, so there were some things that could have been better about my music education growing up. Mm-hmm. And so I started to create online resources about 5 years ago, very seriously, for that reason, for mm-hmm. like 10th grade me to go, if there was someone out there living somewhere where they don't have access to a world-class training situation, at least this is a way to get some of that. It is never going to be a substitute for, in my opinion, live lessons, because as you said, there are things that we do as singers that are really only perceivable as a live entity. And that is why I feel very strongly that live performance is coming back as soon as it can come back. This is not the kind of thing where now we just do everything online, because it is a different neural experience to be with a live singer than it is to hear someone through a speaker. And so but this is an opportunity to reach more people. So I have what's called an online studio, which is just a sort of giant compendium of resources. It's vocalizing, it's videos that I take you through various exercises with. It's giving you a chance to explore different kinds of music. And so that is one of my projects that I have already up and running, but I've spent some time this year trying to make it even more accessible and user-friendly for folks. And then my book comes with this website, thesingingathlete.com. And so I've created a few new classes there. I got really interested in solfege recently in studying the brain, because solfege is such a cool way to go across from left to right brain. It is associating a note with a word, essentially, or a sound. And I became re-fascinated by that in this situation, where it's something that can easily be taught and worked on in a Zoom lesson. And it's just kind of a cool thing to work with. I just did a lot of it as a music student, but hadn't really used it a lot in my own training until, again, pretty recently. So I created a whole course on that this year called the Do Re Mi Vocal Gym, which is a pretty fun little way to get through a progressive solfege training. And so stuff like that are things that are opportunities that are kind of easy to do in this type of a format. And so that's where I'm starting. I'm going to hopefully soon start to do some more online group stuff. I'm trying to create forums for us to just keep working and training and ways to keep motivated, basically, to keep singing.
It's so interesting to me hearing you say that live music will come back, and because there is no real doubt, is there? We need the immediate emotional, visceral connection to the singer, to the musician, right, in order to really get the best experience out of it. And in your book, you talk about the physical aspects of singing.
Yes.
And how present they are. I'd like to, there's, again, so many questions. This idea of physical trauma showing up in your singing.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to ask you what that means, how it shows up for different physical trauma. You mentioned yours and how it showed up in your performance. How does physical trauma show up in singing? And even further, what is the optimal physical state for a singer? Like the two opposites, if you will.
That's great. Yeah. So in my case, so it's, you know, a surgical thing happened, and that happened to be a surgery in my midline structure. So if you think of sort of the center line of your body from your skull down through your pelvic floor, any kind of stuff that's happened in your history in that area can have a fairly direct impact on your singing. And so I mentioned the vagus nerve earlier. If you're on this call and you don't really know that, it's spelled V-A-G-U-S, not like Las Vegas, but vagus in Latin, which means wanderer. And it's your longest cranial nerve. It's your 10th cranial nerve. It goes from your brain to your pelvic floor. And that nerve is 80% sensory. So it's 80% telling you the state of your body. And the motor branches of the vagus, some of the main motor branches are going to your diaphragm, and then they go into every part of your larynx. So any part of singing or speaking is a vagus nerve activity. And so when you've had some kind of midline situation, you've had a C-section, you've had like me a hernia, you've had anything go on in your midline, you have stuff going on with your organs, that's affecting your vagus nerve, and that can show up in your singing, because singing is another branch of the same nerve that's telling you how you're doing, basically. And that's why singing can be so emotional for people, where it's, as you know, if you tear your rotator cuff, that can really suck, but there can be some more emotional stuff when you have this midline issues going on. And so there can be this effect in your singing. And that also, I think, makes singing a great barometer of how you're doing, because it is a great way to know if anything that you're doing for your body is being appreciated, because it will show up in your voice. So if you are trying out a new workout routine, you can do a little singing afterwards and go, how does my voice feel after that? Or even just speaking, as you said, you don't have to be a singer to use your voice to know. You can just talk to a friend and go, how does my voice feel? Does it feel resonant? Do I feel it vibrating in my body? You can use it as an assessment of how you are doing. And so there can be that. And also, of course, emotional trauma can then show up in your voice, because again, your vagus nerve is part of your social connection. And so if you've had something bad happen in an interpersonal experience, that can also translate in your voice. And I talk a little bit in the book about some ways to essentially deal with a scar. And so I say that because I have a giant scar in my pelvic area. But also there are sort of more metaphorical scars. I call them creativity scars in the book. And so I suggest some exercises that some very smart trainer friends of mine have used for essentially emotional rehab a little bit. And that happens a lot with our vision and with our inner ear, because those areas of the body are so instinctual and so old, we start to have this inner ear form even in utero. It's by about 5 months in utero. It's basically already what we have when we come to be adults. It's the same kind of, it's bone basically when we're already still in the womb. And so these are very instinctual parts of the body. And so they can be very fascinating to train and to see what happens to you from a vocal standpoint, but even from how you feel, how your emotions kind of track as you do those exercises.
Fascinating. You mentioned the inner ear.
Yeah.
And I know that you devote healthy chunks of the book to things that might seem a little odd.
Yes.
You know, and just as a thing, for example, yeah. I can understand breath, and I'd love to talk to you about breath and singing. And then, you know, hearing, I can also understand. Vision is a little bit, how does that relate? And tongue. And so can you talk a little bit about the different facets that you decided to focus on, what their importance is, and how they affect singing? Breath, vision, the vestibular system, hearing, tongue, just throw it all at me, because fascinating.
I think I can wrap that into one thing, actually. The basic idea of the thesis of the book is that in the brain, there is this thing called the brain stem, which is part of your brain that connects your spinal cord to the rest of your brain. And that is where the reflexive actions of voice they come out of that area of the brain. Mm-hmm. And so that is where, again, I mentioned your cranial nerves. So you have 12 of them, 10 of them are in your brain stem. And so the idea would be that nerves that fire together wire together. So if there are neighboring structures in your brain, it might look like, say, your eyes are kind of a good distance from your vocal cords, but then you look at it from a neural standpoint and you go, well, actually they're all kind of tied together in there. Mm-hmm. And so to give you a couple examples, so if we use vision, so our cranial nerves, we have 4 of them that control our eyes. They're numbers 2, 3, 4, and 6. And then nerve 5 is called your trigeminal nerve. And that is the nerve that controls vibration in your face. And it also controls a good portion of your tongue and your jaw, structures that we more could think are related to singing. Mm-hmm. Specifically, if you know the term placement as a singer, people will say, you know, place it here. That is really a bone conduction. It's really a resonance that you perceive in your face or your skull. And so that is controlled by your trigeminal nerve, nerve 5. And so if someone has trouble with quote unquote placement, you could also think, interesting. They have myopia. They don't see well close. They have astigmatism. They have an interesting thing where when they look up to the left, every time they start to tear up or their eye turns red or they avoid doing that, their neck does that instead of their eyes doing that. And that can be affecting your trigeminal nerve. It can be affecting your placement, affecting the movement of your tongue and your jaw, because the eyes are so important. They are how we stay out of danger. And to pull it back to your previous question, what is the ideal state for a singer to be in? In my opinion, the ideal state is to have the level of threat be low. And so threat, as we would define it, would be anything that your brain thinks is dangerous. It can be an actual danger or just a perceived danger. It can be treated the same way by your brain. And so vision is a great way to assess threat. If you're out in the park and you see a dog run into your field of vision, you will reflexively look at that dog to go, is this a friendly labradoodle or is it a hungry wolf? You will jump to it. And if you've had stuff happen in your life and then bad things happen when you looked a certain way, your brain can avoid ever looking at that. An example would be if you were in a car accident where you were rear-ended, if you're driving in the US, the last thing you'll probably do is look up into the rearview mirror. So you would probably in the US look up and right before the boom, you get hit. And so what can happen is your brain can go, something really bad happened when I looked up and right. I don't ever want to have that happen again. So I'm never going to do that. And then I stop letting my eyes go to that quadrant. And then my neck starts to do it for me. And I get lots of funny things going on in my posture, lots of pain because I am not using my eyes correctly anymore because I've had a trauma in that area. And so part of the idea of the book is to do some vision exercises to make sure that you are using your eyes, both of them, the ways in every way that they should be used. They are muscles that move the eyeballs just like any muscles in our body, and they're trainable. And often there's a lot of improvement when we start to recapture that, because the vision is so important to your brain. It is in 32-ish different areas of your brain every time you use your eyes. And so it's having this incredible global influence, and it's specifically tied to some things that we need in singing. So it is my opinion that doing vision training as part of your voice work is a really good investment and can get you over some blocks that you may not have known how to deal with.
That makes a lot of sense, looking at it from this perspective. And yet the brain sounds like it's a little silly in this way. Because, you know, there's it's what they call the reptilian brain, or the early brain that goes, oh, something bad happened when I looked up and to the right, therefore I'm never going to look up and to the right again, or I'm going to avoid it.
Exactly.
That doesn't really make sense to someone who's thinking about it, you know, with the frontal cortex. That's exactly it. So the training that you talk about, it's designed to... How does that work? Is it designed to take the more analytical part of you and sort of placate that earlier brain? Or is it designed to help the earlier brain feel more relaxed and therefore allow the looking up and to the right to follow your example?
I would say it's more the second thing, that we're looking at it as, even though we have this conscious brain, as you mentioned, the frontal lobe, that's like, that's stupid. It was just one thing that happened. A lot of us, the vast majority of us, is devoted to survival, to keeping us alive, not tomorrow, but right now. Mm-hmm. And so most of our brain is really doing that all day long. And so we have this consciousness that we go, well, on a cognitive level, I know that that's a silly thing, as you said. But below that, there's this large part of your brain that's like, yeah, but what if? And so we have to find a way to talk to that reflexive part of the brain that's trying to just keep us alive. And so, we're looking at that as a trainable thing. It's sometimes described as like sitting on an elephant. So if you think of like you're riding an elephant, you're like, I'm in charge of this elephant. I got it. I'm up here. But if that elephant decides to go into that lake, you're not going to be able to stop it. And so you can think of it that way, as like, I'm trying to train the elephant a little bit to go, there is all this very subconscious stuff going on. And there are ways to get into that part of the brain stem, as I'm describing it. And so doing some training there is interesting. And then you can be curious about it. And specifically working with performers, they're very rarely told where to look when they are singing something. So I often have people, I test their vision, what happens with them when they look in various distances or directions. And then I will say to them, well, okay, when you get to this section of the song, look here, find something to look at. That's that direction. So I have people use the exit signs a lot in theaters, or use objects on the set. To give them a focal point that for their brain reduces threat and makes them feel safe. And so that is what we are trying to do. And then also long-term, we're trying to rehab anything that the silly brain has been like, I'm scared to do that, because it will eventually shift out of that. If you go, let's just take the rear-ended example again. If you keep spending a little part of every day looking up and right, eventually that silly part of your brain will be like, oh, it's okay. We've done that like every day for weeks. Like, it's actually fine. I don't need to be so worried about that anymore. You just need to convince that survival part of your brain that it is all right. And that is what training is about. It's being diligent and being insisting to that reflexive part of your brain that it's fine.
Okay. So you said that after a while, the brain will go, oh, it's okay. Yeah. What outward sign in the singing voice happens to tell you that you're improving? Like, great. How do you tell?
Yeah, it's a great question. So in our throat, we have what's called constrictor muscles, pharyngeal constrictors. And so their job is to close when we are swallowing, to send food down the esophagus. So when things
and not the trachea.
Not the trachea, correct. That's the wrong pipe. And so we when we're singing poorly, that those start to turn on because they're part of threat, part of what's called the sympathetic nervous system, fight, flight, or freeze. And so when things are not going well with someone's voice, it will start to sound like, ah, and it will start to have this sort of squeezed quality, as we would describe that. Mm-hmm. So these, there are not muscles in the pharynx to quote unquote open the throat. It's sort of a state of having the constrictors off when that's happening. And so you would know that you've entered a threat area of your voice. Of, let's just take this example again of the eyes. So I look up and right when I sing, or I'm staged to do that, which often happens for people who come to me who say, I always hated doing this song in the show. And then I test their eyes and they go, oh, interesting, because I had to look that way when I was doing that song because of the way I was staged. And so let's just say, you know, you're staged to look up and right and you've had this bad car accident. So you look up and right and all of a sudden your voice is like, ah, and it's closing, it's cracking, whatever, not going so well. I'm constricting when I sing. Mm-hmm. So then over the course of a few weeks, I'm going to do exercises into that quadrant of my vision. And to give a quick example, you can do it by holding your eyes up there, what's called a gaze stabilization. You can do it by tracking objects up to that area, called a smooth pursuit. You can do it with a quick flick up to that area, which is called a saccade or saccade in eyes. This is all in the book, so if you want, I'm going fast, but basically there are ways you can start to get into that quadrant. And then you would do that and you would sing whilst doing that a little bit every day, that quote unquote hard phrase of your song. Mm-hmm. And if you're doing the right kind of training, you're going to be like, oh, interesting. Now I'm looking up there and it's not causing my throat to close anymore. So I've done enough reps, enough training in that quadrant that my reptilian brain has decided that that's not so dangerous after all. And I've spent some calories in my brain to create this new habit. And that is an important factor to remember, is that your brain's trying to conserve calories all the time, so it will resist making changes. That's why you need to be diligent with whatever you want to do. If it's being a singer, you got to sing every day because you're trying to tell your brain, hey, this is important to me. You got to spend the calories on this to do that. And even though we know we can run out and get some food whenever we want, pretty much, the subconscious brain is not sure about that. And so it's constantly conserving calories. So you need to keep doing it every day. And then eventually that brain shifts and goes, oh, you keep doing this thing. And okay, I guess it must be fine because nothing bad has happened. We're going to stop constricting your throat now because we've concluded that this is no longer a dangerous activity. It's not a threat to our survival. And then we're going to remove that habit of closing the throat because we have learned that it's not such a bad thing after all.
That's so interesting. When you called it constricted, I call it pinched. My voice sounds pinched when I feel stressed. If I'm trying to sing and I feel stressed, or even if I'm speaking and I can tell when I'm speaking and I'm stressed, everything sounds a little more pinched, closed. Correct. And so I know for myself that I will drop into yoga poses immediately. That's what I do. Sure. As soon as I feel it, I'm like, okay, that's it. I have to go grab my mat and do some yoga. So
great strategy.
Lots of trial and error, and it's what works.
Yeah. Yeah,
so, it works. So let me talk to you about that. What are some good habits for singers and speakers too, who want to have a practice of improving and giving benefit to their voices daily? Can you give a few good practice habits?
Yeah, I'll use myself because that's the easiest way to go with this, I think, because really anything that I wrote in the book could be your magical thing to do. But I'll tell you a couple things from myself. So I have this, my hernia was on my left side. So it's a left inguinal hernia. So what I do when I'm feeling what you described as the pinched quality is I do left side abdominal exercise. And so in the book, I take you through drills for all of the abdominal muscles. So the drills that I explained in the book, I do my left external and internal oblique immediately if I feel that way. And my voice will drastically improve. My range of motion improves. I can do a better forward bend. Any of those things I use as a test. And in the book, I also mentioned that you can use your physical range of motion, your strength or your balance as some secondary confirmation, which is what I prefer to do for myself. So I use my gait, my walking gait, to test how well I'm doing. So what goes completely together is that open-throated feeling goes with a better walking gait. And so I've done a lot of study on that. So I address it a little bit in the book, but I've had my gait analyzed over and over again, and I know what it feels like when it's going better. So I use that. I'll take a little walk and see how I'm feeling. And then I use my range of motion. So I test if I am flexible or inflexible. Again, what goes together is inflexibility and that pinched quality. So I will use that, which is why yoga is a great option, as you described. Personally, for me though, if I do my right abs, not that much changes. If I do my left abs, magic. I'm immediately in a better place. And then I also do stuff on my left palate. And so I take you through some exercises in the book that are for the palate. That's also very, very helpful for me. I have a concussion on the left side of my head. So I work with that scar on my forehead. That also tends to drastically improve me. So I will do either some sensory work, like I mentioned. I use what's called kinesio tape. I will tape my scar in a good direction if I need a little bit of a boost. And I explained in the book and show videos of how you tape something if you're curious about that. So those are some drills that are magic for me. Another one that I will say, because it's really related to the conversation of the pinched throat, that's very simple, is building carbon dioxide. So it's as simple as breathing into a paper bag. If you've seen on, you know, TV shows where someone's having a panic attack, they make them breathe into a paper bag. Mm-hmm. You don't need to be having a panic attack to have that work. So if you want to watch that, you can just go to my Instagram channel. It's @singingathlete. It's pinned to the top of my page. I shot a video of how to do bag breathing. So I do that twice a day anyway, always. But I especially have done that this year because there's been some research around this little virus that's going around, that the people who have that have both low oxygen and low carbon dioxide in their lungs. And so building carbon dioxide can be a good thing to do anyway, but especially if you're concerned about what's been going around, that can be a good practice to be in. And I've done it religiously twice a day for 2 to 3 minutes every day since March. And so that's something that both helps my voice feel better and also is just a good health practice for my own body.
That's fascinating. I didn't know that about carbon dioxide. That's incredible. And that brings me to, I know I could talk to you for the next 4 hours, and I know you
have. I could too. We're having fun. It's great. Yeah. No,
I'm glad. You're welcome back anytime.
I'm having the best time. It's great.
That's terrific. I'm so glad. So let me ask you this idea of breath and singing, speaking, living. The way I look at it always is, you know, you can last 3 weeks without food, 3 days without water, right, and about 3 days without 3 minutes without air.
Yeah, exactly.
So talk to me, if you would, about the importance, sure, of breath in singing for performers and for regular people.
That's a great way to describe it. Yeah. So we mentioned threat earlier in this call. And so you can think about what you just said. We can live for only a few minutes without air. That's probably going to be a really high threat area for a lot of humans, because we're going to die if we don't get oxygen. Sure. And so changing breath can be extremely tricky because it's very high rep, right? We breathe around 20,000 breath cycles a day. That's a whole lot of reps, but it's also an amazing opportunity to change your autonomic system. So autonomic would be the fight, flight, or freeze we mentioned earlier. It's called sympathetic nervous system versus parasympathetic, which is known as rest and digest. So it is a great opportunity to shift, because your diaphragm has what's called somatic fibers in it, in addition to autonomic fibers, meaning it's going to keep you breathing when you sleep and all that stuff, but it's also trainable. And so that makes it a really fascinating chance to affect yourself from an autonomic level, from getting out of stress. And so I devoted 4 chapters to breathing because I am super passionate about it in my own life. I train my own breathing absolutely every day. And I really like others to invest in it as an area to work with. And so I decided to write my first chapter on what I don't see other singing textbooks talk about, which is the balance of oxygen to carbon dioxide. And that is an area that is quite fascinating. It is related to actually Russian training, bringing it all the way back to Belarus. Mm-hmm. So Konstantin Buteyko was one of the first doctors who worked with carbon dioxide. For many years, the material was not in English. So it's only relatively recently that people who don't read Russian have been able to really read about it. And so there's been a lot of cool research around that. And through that, people have sort of extrapolated his stuff to see the value of carbon dioxide. And it's very individual, meaning that not everybody's going to have that response. I personally have a very positive response from building CO2. So simple things that I'll do through my day is stuff that's called reduced breathing, which means just breathing a little bit less, because a lot of singers, we get very used to taking in big, big inhales. And not that that is wrong, but it is also good to see how you do with letting the CO2 be more present in your blood, because hyperventilation, breathing too much too rapidly, is essentially an intolerance to building carbon dioxide in your blood. So if you want to try something on this call, you can just blow your air out and hold your breath on the exhale and just see how long you can do that. You should be able to do it for about 30 to 40 seconds without feeling any panic. If you do that and you make it to 10 to 20 seconds, you are hyperventilating through your day. You're overshooting your oxygen needs, which can cause a few not so good things, but specifically it can keep you into this sympathetic fight or flight anxiety state. Mm-hmm. And so I am very interested with all of my singers that I train to get them to test that and to see how they're doing, to see if they are having symptoms of hyperventilation. Stuff like that can be asthma or allergies, reflux. Those are all things that are related to hyperventilation patterns. Mm-hmm. And so I devoted the first chapter on breathing to a lot of self-testing, but then also the drills that I do around that for myself. And truly everything in the book, I either do every day or have done, have tested on myself. And that particular chapter are things that I do very regularly in my own training. I just did it this morning. So it's pretty cool stuff to play with building carbon dioxide and seeing what that can do for you.
It's so fascinating. I do this exercise, I don't know, 3 or 4 times a day. It's the inhale for 4 seconds, hold for 4 seconds, exhale for 4 seconds, yep. Hold for 4 seconds. And sure. I do it 4 times. And yep. I always feel better. I always feel more yeah. rested and more calm. Yep. And I had not right. thought, I had thought through the oxygenation portion of that, but I had not thought through the carbon dioxide portion of that. So it's fascinating that has that other side of the coin.
Yeah.
We don't tend to think of it. We don't That's tend to right. think of it that way. You know, in, yeah. it's interesting. In plants breathing, it's photosynthesis and then Correct. Carbon dioxide fixation. And one is at daytime, one is at nighttime. And right. it's the plant breathing cycle. So it's interesting for me to hear you talk about this and to relate it finally after all these years of me being alive to my own breath. So fascinating. Yeah. I'm grateful for that. Thank you.
And that's a great drill. I mean, that's I call that box breathing usually, that pattern. And that is another great thing to test. So that's cool that you do that. And then you can do versions where you go, okay, I'm going to go in for 4, hold for 4, go out for 8, hold for 8. And it all comes down to testing to go, do I need more oxygen or more carbon dioxide? And the way you'll know is how you feel after doing those more extended exhales, just to see how you do. And we should also say that singing provides some of that, right? Since we're usually singing on a longer exhale and a quicker inhale. So that's one of the reasons why many times we feel better after we sing, I think, is because we are building carbon dioxide as we sing long phrases of music. We are inherently slowing our exhale down, which is building carbon dioxide in the bloodstream.
And that makes a lot of sense. And it's interesting what you say about the longer exhales and the longer holds after the exhale. I fall asleep when I do that. That's my exercise yeah. to go to yep. sleep is that 4, 4, 4, 6, 4, 8. And then right. by the time I'm done with 8, I'm usually yep. asleep.
Totally. So, that's right.
So let me ask you, I could keep you for another hour and a half easy, but I know you have a day to get to. Can you talk about intent?
Sure.
So
say a little more about, yeah.
Yeah. Go, Andrew, talk about intent. Haha. No, the thing that I'm wondering is, so much of what you've talked about has been subconscious or unconscious sort of results or practices that you're speaking to the sub or unconscious part of yourself. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about what role conscious intent plays in a singer or a speaker who's following your process and your system?
Yeah, absolutely. So of course, yes, we talked a lot about reflexive brain paths, mostly because I find that to be an area that isn't talked about a lot in other training systems. So I just wanted to always make sure that people understand that stuff is going on. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, obviously we do have this conscious brain that is providing messages, signals essentially to this. We are able to send messages to this area consciously. And so the last chapter, or the second to last chapter, I should say, so I described it in the book. You mentioned the reptilian brain. I went with the terms of first brain and a second brain in the book. So first brain is this reflexive stuff, and second brain I'm describing as the more conscious areas of the brain. And so, yeah, that is very trainable stuff as well. And I chose in the book to break it down by lobe of the brain. And if you're not a big brain nerd like us, so there are four main lobes and a fifth one that can be considered separate. So they're frontal, temporal, parietal, occipital, and then I chose to also use what's called the insular lobe of the brain. And so when we're dealing with intent, when we're creating a plan, we're creating an action, we are doing that in this conscious part of our brain, especially the frontal lobe. And so there are some cool things with the frontal lobe, especially around stuff like chronic pain and depression and anxiety. So there's a particular part of your frontal lobe called the big word here, dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. And that part of the brain has been shown to respond positively to task switching. So one of the things that I try to get people to do in their intent is to vary their singing styles and their material. So I really like singers to work with different genres and different styles of music. Even if you think I'm a rock singer, I love it if you'll study a classical piece. If you're a classical singer, I love if you will study a rock piece, because it can be really good for that part of your brain. And that is a part that I wish I had known about back in the day, because I had a lot of chronic pain and then I got a lot of depression. And that probably resulted in some less robust use of this particular part of my frontal lobe. And so having more variety in your training and having more switches can be really, really useful. And that is where a great teacher comes in, which is why a teacher's jobs are not going away, because we need somebody to give us novelty. We need someone to do something a little differently every time. And if you just do the exact same lesson all the time, you're eventually going to get bored and this part of your brain's going to kind of shut down. So you need a little bit of stimulus, something new, a new way to hear something, a new way to work with the same concepts. And all great teachers are finding ways to do that, to wake up your brain just enough to give you that that signal that you need to get to your next level of motor control, of being able to use your voice properly. So yeah, and intent and how you practice is really important. I wrote a whole chapter on practice because I think that many people don't really know how to practice. And so I tried to give some guidelines in the chapter about here are some good habits, and that is one of them. I think switching your styles more and your repertoire is a good practice.
Absolutely. And it's also that variety stimulates you. It stimulates you to look at things differently and to look at the song, your performance of it, how to interpret it, and how to make it, what I tell my singers, how to make the song yours. You know, that's Absolutely. Something that's so important. As a singer, you can't, it's funny, going to karaoke or something like that, people often want to hear the song done the way it's done on the album by the, you know, if for me, it's Natural Woman by Aretha, you know, sung by Aretha Franklin. And I can't be Aretha Franklin. There's no way for me to be Aretha Franklin. So
no one else is going to be Aretha. That's
exactly.
True.
So that idea of providing yourself that variety is fabulous. And I'm so glad that you address it, because I think it helps on the whole person, not just the singer person, but the whole person, find out and develop those interests that you might get sparked in a way that you never thought possible. So I'm really grateful that you put that in the system.
Yeah.
I, as I said, I could keep you for another 4 hours, but I know that you have things to do, and I would love to have you back and talk more about your forward process and your next book, but also your plans as far as singers in general and the singing community, performing community. I would love that. But before we go, there are just a couple more things. Yeah. I would love it if you would say what your social media links are, just so that we have them on here. I'll put them in the show notes, of course, but if there's anything that you think that needs to be on that show notes page, Andrew, please tell me and I will put that in. So your Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, any of that, how do people find you?
Totally. So my website is just andrewbyrne.com. It's BYRNE.com, like Irish spelling. thesingingathlete.com is where you get information about the book and you get the video guide that goes with it, as well as a whole bunch of other cool classes, many of which are free. So Isolde just mentioned that I'm really trying to keep us all going. So I put some free classes up there with vocalizing patterns. There's a warm up for legit singing, one for pop rock singing, and one for mixed belt singing. So if you want to try some new exercises to get your dorsolateral prefrontal cortex going, you can go there.
Yes.
And do that, thesingingathlete.com. And then I'm on Instagram, it's @singingathlete. And then I'm also on Facebook. It's just Andrew Byrne Studio. So if you just type that into Facebook, it will come up. My group will come up there. And I'm on YouTube as well. If you just type in my name, tons of stuff will come up there. Andrew Byrne, B-Y-R-N-E. I also have shot a ton of classes for Backstage. So Isolde mentioned Backstage at the beginning. I also have done a lot of writing and video content for them. So if you want to do some really great classes on some of the topics we talked about, you can just type me into Backstage and they'll all come up there. I did all 20-minute courses, one on balance, one on your tongue. I did several on different kinds of warm-ups. So you can just, for hours, keep yourself busy with cool brain-based voice training stuff there if you want.
Oh, you, the brain nerd in me is just giddy. This stuff, the thing about this stuff is that it works. It really works.
Yeah. We can
dance around it all we want, but the brain is the boss in that way. And
that's right.
We don't think of it in those terms.
I didn't say this earlier, but it's also good to remember that it's really a young field because of MRIs. We didn't have the ability to know what's going on until really the mid-90s when we started to get this information. Mm-hmm. And so it's a fascinating field because we're learning new stuff about it every day. And my greatest mentors in this field are incredibly up on the newest research. That mm-hmm. is the people who I seek out to work with. I have a very high standard for teachers, and my teachers in this field are very up on this study just came out last week, and this is what we think this might mean for us in a practical way. And that's why it's such a cool thing. As you said, it is the boss, it's in charge of us. And also we are getting now, one of the great things about being alive now is that we're getting more concrete information on it to go, when we do this, this lights up in the brain. How are we going to access that? And that makes it a very fertile area to be doing research and thinking about, because it is really changing by the day.
Absolutely. And the thing about this field of research and study is that once you have a thread, it's amazing how many different areas you can then access.
Right.
To follow. It's like solving a grand mystery. And and again, the brain is the boss. So it's really
boss.
It is so incredible and so inspiring, because there are certain things I think that we haven't given credit to in ourselves, our incredible abilities that our brain gives us when we need them. Totally. And that's something that we can control, and that's something that we can improve. And The Singing Athlete is one of the books and systems that's going to let you do that. So bear that in mind. So Andrew, I have one last question that I ask everyone who comes on the show, and it is a silly question, and yet I find it's often quite profound. Here is the question. But before I ask it, actually, I want to thank you so much for joining me on the show. Such a wonderful experience to hear you talk about something that I adore. And it's, you know, in such an eloquent and articulate and obviously knowledgeable way. So I'm so grateful to you for spending the time.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been just an absolute treat. And as I said, you are my people. So it's so nice to get to talk further with you. And I just had a great time.
Oh, I'm so glad. Yay. And as I said, you're welcome back anytime.
I'll come back.
Perfect. No worries. So here's the question. If you had an airplane that could skywrite anything for the whole world to see, what would you say?
I am going to go with my gut. And this is really based on right now in our life, but I would just have it write, "Keep singing."
You are my people.
That was the first that came to my mind. So that's what I'm going to say. Keep singing.
Keep singing. That's it. That's all that needs to be said. I think that's wonderful. No, seriously, because I say that at the end of every class I teach, that's what I tell every student, every organization I work with. keep singing is usually singing. The keep breathing, keep singing is what I say, but keep singing. Yeah. Keep singing. So, yes. Thank you again, Andrew. I'm so grateful and what a delightful conversation. I'm so excited to share this out. If you liked what you heard, get in touch with Andrew, get the singing athlete. You need to know more about this and not just if you're a singer, you do not have to be a singer, I think, to get the benefits from this system. And that's something that I sound like a commercial right now, but think about it. Think about the idea of training your brain to really be the sort of benevolent boss that you want your brain to be. Think about that. Think about working with your brain instead of wondering what the heck is wrong and not being able to figure it out. So please, you know, find Andrew Byrne, look at the singing athlete, at the very least go and get to some of those amazing classes that Andrew has made available. And I have a feeling you're going to want to know more. I want to thank you so much for joining us for this incredible conversation. I'm so inspired to go sing now. Which is fabulous. Yeah. And if you like what you're hearing, do me a favor, leave a review for the show and let Andrew know you've figured out how to find him now at Singing Athlete. Mm-hmm. Find him, follow him. Obviously, you're going to learn a lot. Until next time for the Innovative Mindset Podcast, this is Isolde Trachtenberg, and I'm going to say, keep breathing, keep singing. Thanks so much for joining me today. I really appreciate you being here. Today's episode was produced by Isolde Trachtenberg and is copyright 2020. As always, please remember this is for educational and entertainment purposes only. Past performance does not guarantee future results, although we can always hope. Until next time, this is Isolde Trachtenberg, and I send you all of my love.